Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Hi, and welcome to It's Our Money, where we look behind the curtain at what's really going on with our money and what's liable to be going on with it in the future. This week, we'll be looking behind the curtain of global monetary control and how it's locking us into ongoing debt. And we'll meet a couple who are showing how citizens can take action to lead us out of the banker's traps, Kevin Zeiss and Margaret Flowers. But first, I want to talk about some news from Europe and how this bodes ill for your money, not only if it's in European bank accounts, but if it's in American bank accounts. On March 20th, EU officials finally agreed to a banking union, something they've been arguing about for a long time. If you read the news about it, all the news is about how they've finally reached agreement, which is a pretty historic thing. But what they aren't discussing is that the terms of the deal include not only bailouts, where all the Eurozone countries have agreed to pool a certain amount of money, and then if one of these 130 major banks that is covered by the banking union goes bankrupt, it can tap into that pool for a bailout. But before they can get this bailout money, they have to bail in their creditors' money, and we know that creditors include the depositors. In fact, the depositors are the largest class of creditor of any bank. Theoretically, if you're an insured depositor, you're protected. But the problem is that this was supposed to be a three-pronged deal, and the third prong, which was deposit insurance, wasn't agreed to by the Eurozone countries. So it's still out there in limbo. And if you happen to be a depositor in one of those countries that is subject to a major banking meltdown, like Greece or Spain or Italy are likely suspects, your only recourse is to your own government's deposit insurance, and those are the countries that are least likely to have the money to cover the deposits. So the depositors are likely to lose their shirts. And how likely is a major meltdown? Well, Mario Draghi, who is the president of the European Central Bank and who was instrumental in negotiating this deal, isn't telling until after the deal is sealed. In other words, until after the depositors and the taxpayers are on the hook for paying for these bankrupt banks' bailouts and bail-ins. Then, he says, the EU is planning to do very in-depth assessments of the condition of these banks. And it's pretty widely known that their condition is pretty bad. So when the investors and the depositors and the creditors all find out how bad it is, it's anticipated that they'll all flee, which means that the banks will go bankrupt and there will be a major meltdown. But not to worry, because at that point, the taxpayers and the depositors will be on the hook and the banks will once again survive at the expense of the people. And what I'm writing about this week is something else that's quite unsettling that was in the U.S. news. On March 14th, the FDIC announced that it was suing 16 of the world's largest banks for rigging the LIBOR rate. Now, we've heard about LIBOR rigging before, but generally these cases have settled out or they've been big fines, but we didn't have necessarily definitive proof. But this is the FDIC suing all of the banks that were involved that set the LIBOR rate. It's the London Interbank Offering Rate, and it's used in over $400 trillion worth of interest rate swaps. Huge. That's trillion with a T. That's like seven times the gross domestic product of all the countries in the world. One of my favorite commentators on this sort of subject is Professor Bill Black, who teaches law and economics and was a bank fraud investigator in the savings and loan scandals. So he calls these 16 banks, which are the largest banks in the world, the largest cartel in world history by at least three or four orders of magnitude. It includes the three largest U.S. banks. That would be JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup. And the three largest UK banks, and the largest German bank, and the largest Japanese bank, and several of the largest Swiss banks. So this is a global cartel that is ruling the world. And they have colluded to manipulate the interest rates, which means they all had to agree. If anybody didn't agree, it would have blown the whole deal. So this is the literal definition of an illegal cartel. So you might wonder, why are we still doing business with these banks? The biggest victims of these interest rate swaps are state and local governments and public hospitals, public universities, public entities. So that's what I'm writing about now. I'm particularly writing about California because I'm running for California State Treasurer. And what damage these interest rate swaps have done in California, and what California should and could do about it. They could, at the very least, all these entities that have been trapped in these interest rate swaps should renegotiate the deal and get a better deal. But what I would say, they should actually sue for rescission and restitution and damages. They could get damages for fraud. The reason they don't, no doubt, is that everybody thinks that we're dependent on the Wall Street banks for our banking needs, that no other banks are big enough to deal with the deposits and the banking needs of state and local governments. The bottom line is that we cannot trust Wall Street, we can't depend on Wall Street, and we really shouldn't be doing business with Wall Street. We need to create our own banks, and we need to start taking individual action and showing personal leadership. And our guests today are doing just that.
It's my great pleasure to be interviewing Kevin Zeis and Margaret Flowers, two lifelong political activists who have been in the forefront of a number of movements for social, political, and economic reform. Kevin is an attorney who began his advocacy career while in law school, where he worked at the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He went on to serve as their chief counsel and national director. He's advocated for many popular causes since then. He served as press secretary and spokesperson for Ralph Nader in 2004 and ran for the U.S. Senate in 2006. Margaret Flowers is a Maryland pediatrician who left practice in 2007 to advocate full-time for a single-payer health care system. She served as congressional fellow for positions for a national health program from 2009 to 2010, and she writes and speaks about health policy reform, specifically a national Medicare for all health system. She and Kevin have appeared on numerous radio and TV programs and write regularly in Truthout and Al Jazeera English. Among many other things they do together is to co-host a radio program called Clearing the Fog and to co-direct It's Our Economy, which advocates for democratizing the economy so that it serves all Americans. Kevin is Attorney General of the Green Party's Shadow Cabinet, and Margaret is Secretary of Health. And I'm actually Secretary of the Treasury. I'm also running for California State Treasurer. I was also a student body treasurer in high school, if anybody cares. So welcome, Kevin and Margaret.
Great. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you for having us, Ellen.
Yeah. The article that I just read that I thought was really interesting and I wanted to ask you about, it was dated April 2nd, and it was on the Real News Network, called Waves of Nationwide Actions Planned at Key Historic Moment. I think you wrote about the same thing in several other places. So I wondered if you could tell us what these waves of nationwide action are and what the key historic moment is.
Well, I think maybe talking about the key historic moment first, and then, Kevin, you could describe what's going on. But, you know, we're really in this amazing time where we have such a confluence of crises on many fronts. You know, the economic crises, the healthcare crisis continues, the climate change is becoming more and more of a tangible reality to us. And we also have a growing wealth divide and people that are starting to organize and become more politically aware and recognize we're not in a situation where we can look to our so-called leaders to solve the problems for us. They're just completely incapable, and the system in which we live is one that, you know, strengthens the wealthy and weakens the rest of us. And so I think it's this combination of these crises and this growing awareness that it's going to be the people that needs to change the situation that puts us in this really transformative time in history.
And the actions we were talking about are, what we like about them is that they're campaigns. They're not just one-day events. And so they have an opportunity to build, and they have an opportunity to react to whatever occurs over the next few months. The first one is the Worldwide Wave of Action, and you can follow that on Twitter, @WaveOfAction. And it goes from April 4th, the day that Martin Luther King died, to July 4th, Independence Day. And that's a series of people create their own local actions around the country, around the kinds of issues that Margaret was talking about. And show, you know, people getting organized and not wanting to take this these directions anymore. The other that we think is of interest is the climate convergence, which goes from Earth Day to May Day, 10 days, April 23rd to May 1st. And it tries to show that when you talk about Earth Day, it's more than just planting trees. It's about really the concept that all the issues we face are connected. That the immediate crisis of climate change that's coming upon us, and we saw the Sony UN report gets upon us now and has implications for everybody on the planet, and the labor issues that we talked about on May Day, but really everything is affected by this. These issues, the quality of our foods, the availability of water, our access to health care, these are all part of a living planet, and a planet, it's a Gaia, it's a living system, and these things are all connected. And so it's trying to broaden the concept of Earth Day to show how the ecology and health of the planet is really related to all aspects of life. Another one I'll just mention is Reset the Net, which is just starting, and people are working now to try to retake the Internet and restore privacy. And there are a lot of things that will be done along this. There'll be a day of action in early June that will be announced to kind of bring it all together. But in the meantime, people are working with their Internet providers to try to get them to put in place protections to prevent the NSA and others from spying on Internet activities. And they're going to be putting together information for individuals to take action of their own to protect themselves on the Internet. Now, I really like about this is that we're taking action ourselves to take back the Internet. We know the NSA is spying and the Dragnet surveillance system. And now we have to now we can figure out what we can do to take it back ourselves and create a privacy on the Internet again. And so these actions, you know, they come at an interesting time. Margaret mentioned the kind of broad outlines of the crises we face, but we're at a point where the stock market's at a very high level. It's a bubble created by the Federal Reserve's putting massive amounts of money, tens of billions a month, into the big banks. But that's now slowing down that qualitative easing. And China, another big source of money, is starting to put its money into its own country rather than investing abroad as much. So big sources of money that were going into the markets are diminishing. And so that bubble is going to burst at some point. And as I mentioned, climate change, the UN report just came out. And on issue after issue, we could have a crisis in the next few months. So as these campaigns are going forward, people are getting in position to take the opportunity and build the movement. And that's really what you have to do at this stage of the movement, is build a broad national consensus from the grassroots up. And that's what these campaigns help to do.
I really like the idea. It seems to me that we have many different little movements going on. Not little, but you know what I mean?
Right.
Movements that are all sort of in their own little boxes, and they're not getting together. And so none of them actually succeeds because they're just not powerful enough. They're little tiny waves. But if you could get everybody together, the 99% obviously, literally, has the numbers. And so we should and could be able to move the dial, you know, actually get some things done with a huge wave. But then the problem is getting everybody to agree. Like even, like my thing is the money reform movement. Even in the money reform movement, the real opposition isn't from Congress. I mean, they don't even pay any attention to us. It's from the other money reformers who are all vying with each other to try, you know, they all have a theory about how to fix the system, and everybody thinks that all the others don't know what they're talking about or are wrong. And I was in the healthcare movement or the alternative healthcare movement in the 90s, and it was the same way where you had all these brilliant mavericks who just couldn't get it together. And so they were, or get together, they were always sort of shooting at each other. They all thought the others were quacks. And so they brought themselves down rather than, you know, the opposition didn't even have much work to do because they shot at their own feet or whatever. So I think that's the hard part is, I know this movement is supposedly a leaderless movement, but then how do you get agreement on exactly what we're trying to achieve and getting everybody behind it?
I think I've seen that same problem, you know, a lot in every movement I work in. You know, nuanced differences become chasms of debate and discussion and divide. And really that does do the work of the opposition for them, because divide and rule is their greatest tactic. And so we need to find ways to unify. And that is nothing like what these movements are going for now, is that they're broad enough, they're allows everyone to put forward their issue, and so you can move forward. I don't think it's really a leaderless movement. People like to use that terminology. I think it's a very leader-filled movement, and that it down to the grassroots, we have people who are leading in their communities, and we should acknowledge that and not hide it. I think if you pretend it's leaderless, you end up having leaders who aren't accountable. And, you know, our job, I think the job of leaders is to really make it possible for people to accomplish what they want to accomplish, and to provide people the tools and the information and whatever they need to, you know, accomplish their goals. And so put out ideas and provide tools, and if people want to follow, they can. So our job really is to, and we try to do that through our major websites, popularresistance.org. And Popular Resistance tries to bring all these different movements together. We call them sub-movements. We see 10 sub-movements, the, you know, climate, housing, education, healthcare, militarism, labor rights. So we see 10 sub-movements, and bringing those sub-movements together creates a mass movement. And that's really the goal, is to have a mass movement that can't be ignored. And so that's the first step, really, is bringing these movements together. And beyond that is building, you know, pulling more people in into these movements. And so that's our next task.
Well, I love the whole concept that the Occupy movement, of course, made a great progress, but then it kind of got blocked. But now it's another wave, you know, that wave after wave, eventually we will overcome, because it will just get stronger and stronger. I wonder if you could bill it as everybody's a leader, but then maybe, you know, in their own little, like in your local community, if you act, if you take charge, if you go out there and do something, you're leading, even if it's in a very small thing. You're leading in your particular corner of the movement every little way.
Well, that's actually, yeah, I mean, we've often called it a leader-full movement, and I think that's really essential. You know, as I was saying earlier, we can't look for these so-called others, these other leaders, to do things for us. A leader is really somebody who takes action. And so we are all, you know, everybody that's doing something is a leader in their own way. And with leadership comes, you know, responsibility. You have to be accountable to others, you know, if you're going to take action. And so I think that's just really important for people to understand that there's nothing special about being a leader. Anybody can be a leader, but you have to take action.
Yeah, I just would add to that. Right now, this movement probably involves, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out of hundreds of millions in the United States. And so if you're one of those hundreds of thousands who's taking action, you're a leader because you're one of the first to get involved. This is going to become a mass movement. This is going to become a movement that is the equivalent of a civil rights movement or a women's suffrage movement. It's going to become a mass movement. That's we're at a critical phase in our history where the rule of money, as we saw in the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision yesterday, the rule of money really is the central issue that links us all together. And our task is to end the rule of money so we can advance the issues that we all care about. And I think if we build that kind of mass movement to push that forward, it'll be a very historic time in our history. So if you're involved now, you're one of the early people getting involved. And so that just automatically defines you as a leader.
Yeah, you're leading the wave. You're at the
right
tip.
My particular interest is how to fund all this. It seems to me if we've got the money, what blocks us from doing anything politically, et cetera, is we don't have the money, but we actually do. We don't understand what money is. And if we reconceptualize it and realize that we've been parasitized or exploited by a system that we don't really need and that we can set up our own system, that would be my particular area of leadership, I think.
That's a very important area. That's a very important area. Remaking money, rethinking money so we understand it in a broader way, I think, is critical to creating the kind of new economy you want to see.
And that brings up a couple of important points. Is, you know, one is that resistance is not just protesting. Another
right.
important part of this phase, in addition to developing political awareness, is developing alternative models to replace the current systems that we have that are dysfunctional. So the creation of those alternative systems, as we see people pursuing efforts at creating public banks, at the growing cooperatives and collectives, the growing movement for land trusts, and municipalizing energy and moving to renewable energy. All of these actions that are going on all around the country in different communities are creating these alternative systems, and they're going to help to guide the rest of us.
Yeah, looking at it that way, I think it's a really good thing to publicize all those things that are going on, so that
yes.
people do tend to get discouraged and they think, oh, what can I do? I know that, you know, we've got wars and government is corrupt and it's hopeless, and so I'll just lead my life. But when you realize that there are all these things going on and they're sort of coordinated, I mean, they're all moving toward a different sort of goal than what our politics is, you know, what you say.
No question. That's very important. I mean, and there are people trying to do that. But, you know, we can't rely on the corporate mass media to do that. They're going to, in fact, ignore it intentionally. And
right.
you know, one of the things we've been fighting is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that really teaches us that we don't need the corporate media to get the word out. The TPP has been ignored by the media, suppressed by the media, yet most people now know about it and oppose it. And so we have the power in our own media to get that kind of word out, and I think you're exactly right. People need to know that that others are taking action and that new systems are being developed. And so that gives people optimism that something can be done and there's somewhere for them to join.
Mm-hmm. TPP was another thing I wanted to ask you about. You've definitely been leaders there in the forefront of exposing what it's all about and the fact that fast track is really dangerous and why it is and stuff. Could you capitalize a bit? And I'm interested in knowing the state of, you know, where it is right now.
Sure. Well, your listeners, you know, most of them should know, maybe. I don't know that
the TPP
stands for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a trade agreement that the Obama administration has been negotiating for the past 4 years with a number of Pacific countries, you know, Japan and Australia and New Zealand, Vietnam, Brunei, Chile, Peru. Canada and Mexico are part of it as well. And it's a very far-reaching agreement that does much more than just deal with trade, but it really results in creating a huge corporate power grab and creating a tribunal or extra-legal judicial system that allows corporations to sue governments if those governments have policies that interfere with expected profits. And for the first time in history, the text of this trade agreement has been classified so that the public doesn't know what's in it. Even our members of Congress have very restricted access to finding out what's in it, but over 600 corporate advisors are allowed to look at the text on their computers and, you know, advise on changes to it. So there was a blackout, or still is a blackout, in the media, and people have been working to get around that using social media and alternative blogs, and so it's really been well publicized, and a lot of pressure has been put on Congress. The president has been trying to get Congress to give him something called fast track or trade promotion authority that would allow him to sign the agreement before it goes to Congress, and then when Congress does have it, they have limited time to read it, debate it, and then they can only vote up or down. They can't make amendments. And so the president had been trying to get that bill through Congress for years, and finally a bill was introduced early this year. But because of public pressure, we were able to get enough members of Congress to come out against it that seems to be pretty much dead for now. What is important is that we need to continue to organize, because it's likely that it will resurface after the midterm elections or early next year. And it's likely that, you know, this current Trade Promotion Authority bill that was put forward was so bad that many members of Congress were willing to come out against it. But they may try to create a kind of a kinder, gentler, and that's what we're hearing now, form of fast track, where they say, oh, well, it's going to have protections for workers, protections for the environment, so everything's okay, don't worry. And the truth is that no fast track at this point is acceptable of any sort.
It's hard for me to understand why any other country would enter into these agreements. I saw that Canada and Japan are now balking at the agricultural, the part where they have to open up their agriculture, which they absolutely shouldn't. I mean, why would Japan want to open? It's got all those people to feed, and we know that various trade agreements that have caused the devastation of agriculture in
right, well, just look at NAFTA, what it did to Mexican agriculture.
Yeah. So why would they enter? I just don't understand why would they even consider it.
Well, I think the major, there's two reasons. One is, first off, the United States is a quarter of the world economy. And so while we're having our economic struggles, we shouldn't forget we are still, 25% of the world's economy. And so countries like Vietnam and Chile and even countries like Japan, want to have us as a trading partner because we buy stuff. And Japan is the third largest economy in the world, but it's totally stalled. It's struggling. It's been struggling for more than 10 years. And so they're kind of desperate. And so even a big economy like that is worried. And so I think that's the major reason. The second thing is, the problem of neoliberalism and wealth divide is not limited to the United States. In many of the countries around the world, the wealthy dominate. And trade agreements like the TPP make the wealthy wealthier. They do drop a few little, like I expect that Vietnamese workers will go from 15 cents an hour to 30 cents an hour for their minimum wage. But the wealthier who make the policies get wealthier. And so it's to their benefit. And so we're in this problem worldwide, really. And that's why there's a global revolt against neoliberalism. And I think in the United States, we have the biggest responsibility because we are a big economy. We're the biggest military. And we have now to, figure out a way to end this dominance of wealth. And so we can put in place a system that really gives power to the people, that allows for economic democracy, allows for participatory democracy, and really can transform the direction the country is going on so many issues. And I think a lot of it starts with the work you're doing on remaking finance.
Well, and the work you're doing, I think it's very important to expose those issues so that people realize that it's not us, it's not helping us personally, it's our big moneyed interests that are controlling our governments, that have basically hijacked our governments. Brzezinski said in the Grand Chessboard that the neocons wanted, that Eurasia was the key to global dominance, and of course that's what they want, full spectrum dominance. So I also read that the TPP was about excluding China or preventing China from partnering with, I guess, Russia and Germany. But it sounds like maybe they're forming their own trade deal that will exclude us.
That's exactly right. The Asian countries, which I think would be much wiser for them than to get involved with the TPP, are forming an Asian trade deal, that will increase trade among Asian countries. And I think that probably has a much better chance of becoming reality than TPP does. But yes, full spectrum dominance is the goal of U.S. empire. And there's only a few countries that are remaining in the way. The two big ones are Russia and China. After that, I'd say Iran and Venezuela. And, the United States is putting pressure on China with the Asian pivot and the economic aspect of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're seeing how the U.S. is surrounding Russia by expanding NATO now into the Ukraine, where the U.S. spent $5 billion to replace that government with now a friendly government. We see the pressure the U.S. is putting on Venezuela, funding the opposition, trying to create an opposition political movement. And, of course, we know the kind of pressure the U.S. is putting on Iran. But those are the kind of independent countries that the United States wants to really dominate. And that's not an easy task. The United States hasn't won a war in a long time, since World War II, really, have not won a major war. And our economy is in a struggling mode. While it's the biggest in the world, it has some very serious problems, foundational problems, how we make money, how our wealth divide, the weakness of the middle class and down to the poor. I mean, it's really some very fundamental problems in the U.S. economy. So while we see ourselves, people in the government see themselves as on the verge of really dominating the world, they may just be a few steps away, but those steps are going to be pretty hard to take. And I think that we may see a fall before we see that kind of hegemony finalized.
We are in perilous times, but it's perilous times when things change. So that's what I hope, that we'll be peering over the cliff and we'll see the bottom and turn around before we hit. But we may have to hit first, like in the 1930s. But it's amazing the things that Roosevelt did in the 1930s. I mean, it's just unbelievable that government could take charge and do all those things. But
That took decades to get to. I mean, FDR, was the product of work that was done in the teens. with the Populist Party and the Socialist Party and the Progressive Party, and then in the, of course, the economic collapse in the late 1920s, really kind of pushed them into that. And there was continuing pressure while he was president from Huey Long and his effort to, you know, a populist kind of approach of every man a king when talking about much fairer, equitable distribution of wealth. And you know, the socialist parties continued in that era, and there was always a fear by Roosevelt being challenged from the left. So I think that kept the pressure on him at the time when the economic collapse occurred. And so it's not just FDR who did it. It's really the people's movements that
right.
were pressuring. And I think it's always important to remember we kind of write history in terms of individual presidents and, you know, individual heroes, but it's really not that. It's really mass movements of people power that really change the direction of countries. And every major breakthrough we've had in our history has had that at its root.
Yeah, well, it's hopeful. I've seen charts of the wealth gap, and it shot up exponentially right before the 1930s, and it's shot up exponentially now, particularly since the late 1990s when banking was, all bets were off, and, you know, it was totally banking, the regulations were opened up so that they could do all these outrageously speculative things. So we're doomed to repeat the 1930s, I think. So I hope we come up with some good. That's my, you know, people say, well, how are you going to get from here to there? How are you going to get your state bank implemented? But I think when we see some big banks collapse, or when we start seeing bail-ins where they're snatching our deposits, at that point people are going to go, they're just not going to support the current system anymore, and they'll be looking for something else. So I think our function would be to create those blueprints so there's somewhere to go when we tip over the edge.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really key point to understand that could make this time different from you know, what happened back in the 1930s, because in a big way, the policies that Roosevelt put forward were able to take some of the pressure off so that the capitalist system could continue to operate. And there was some improvement for a while we had these policies in place that, you know, allowed people to get an education, to afford a house, to afford health care, and, you know, to meet their basic needs. But as those policies have shifted and more of our public dollars are going to the large corporations while our basic services are being cut, you know, we're kind of seeing capitalism default back to its position of, you know, what it generally creates. And I think that now we're seeing more and more people question the whole system and understanding that if we just try to change within the current system, eventually we're going to get back to where we are again, that we need a whole new system. And so you're part of the forefront yeah. of defining that new system. There are other people like Gar Alperovitz and people that are involved in the new economy projects that are helping to define this new system that's not going to be a capitalist system which doesn't value human life or protection of the planet. It's not going to be, you know, a state socialist system. It's going to be some sort of democratized economy that puts more of the, you know, public wealth in the hands of the public to manage in a democratic way. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm always hopeful, even though things look pretty bleak. Margaret, I was going to ask you more about, you've been pushing for Medicare for All, which I totally agree with. I just wonder what you think of Obamacare and how you would, you know, what's the hope there? How are we going to jump over to a system that works?
Right. Well, I don't know if you were aware that this week I published a article basically stating that I'm a conscientious objector to the Affordable Care Act. Monday was the deadline, March 31st, for people to have insurance. And so I was faced as an uninsured person who doesn't qualify for one of the public programs like Medicaid or Medicare with being mandated to give my money to the private insurance corporations that I've been working so hard to get rid of. And so I was urged to go public with my decision to be a conscientious objector. Kevin is also a conscientious objector, as well as now we've been joined by more than 400 people who made the same decision. These were personal decisions. I didn't ask anybody to do that. People had already come to that decision themselves. And it's been interesting because it's provided an opportunity to have more of this kind of debate about what actually the Affordable Care Act is, and the fact that it's like other neoliberal policies that we've been seeing put forward, that it's transferring our public dollars into the private insurance industry's hands. It's degrading our public insurances. Those are becoming more privatized. The delivery of healthcare in this country is becoming more privatized. It's actually taking us in the opposite direction from where we need to go. But there's been all this, because it was passed by a Democrat, that kind of reality has been hidden, and you've been hearing, you know, people have been hearing in the media just all this like hype about how wonderful it is that more people are getting insurance without telling them that, that what they're getting is not any kind of security, that their health needs are going to be met. So I think that, you know, we have a ways to go with continuing to develop that education and get people to kind of open their eyes from all these distractions in the media that are leading them to believe that it's positive. There is a piece of legislation in Congress that's still there. It's been there since 2003, and every session it gets reintroduced. It's called H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. And people are starting to get more active around that now. May 22nd is going to be a National Lobby Day. A number of large groups are coming together to organize that. So I think now is really the time for people to be having a discussion about whether we want to treat healthcare as a commodity and use a market-based system that's already been shown to fail, or do we want to join the rest of the industrialized nations and treat healthcare as a public good and create a system that actually supports that, a Medicare for All system. So I think if we can have that debate and continue to organize to build support for H.R. 676, it'll put us in a good direction. And I think over the next year or so, more and more people are going to become aware that what was sold to them as a solution is really not providing the health security they thought that it would.
My concern is that we're promoting the wrong kinds of remedies. It's not just the insurance issue, but the fact that drug companies obviously make a lot more money if they have a drug that you have to stay on for 30 years and take it every day than something that'll instantly cure people. They don't really want cure. I mean, cure is not a marketable thing, not nearly as marketable as long-term illness. So they want people, I mean, I shouldn't say they want it. I'm sure they're well-meaning.
Well,
but
their business model.
Yeah, their business model is that they're better. Well, I know somebody who had a remedy and went to a drug company, and the drug company man said, well, that's an interesting idea, but, you know, we won't develop it. And he said, why not? And he said, well, we can't really make any money off that.
That's the root of the problem. You know, and Obamacare has made this worse. I mean, the ACA really puts forward essentially Wall Street health care. It's a form of healthcare that makes healthcare at every stage into a commodity, into a profit center, into an investment opportunity, and rather than a public good and a human right. And I think we see that really on many issues, that profit comes first. We don't put the people's necessities or the protection of the planet ahead of profit. Profit is number one. And of course, that's because we live in a plutocracy where the wealthiest rule. You know, so the foundation of the democracy really is no longer legitimate. It's really no longer a legitimate democracy. It's not of, by, and for the people. That's just not what it is. And so I think we have to start to talk about our democracy that way as being illegitimate, and really start to challenge the bottom line approach, which is money first. And that starts with changing the way we elect people, but it's every issue and how the finance system works. You see this all the time in that. You see it all the time in the how we deal with the environment, how we deal with workers. It's just, and so we've got to get away from this Wall Street investment approach to public goods.
You know, I see moving to a Medicare for All system as really just a first step. We have to get profit out of our healthcare system and make the bottom line health before we can start to do the common sense approaches of, like, looking at what our health needs are, looking at, you know, what's causing them, what public policies can we change to actually support the health of our communities instead of making them sicker? What are the medical needs that we have that should be driving our research rather than profit? You know, what if the government, or if we have a single public system that's deciding what will be purchased, then we have the power to say, well, you know, we want you to go out and create something that's going to address this health problem. And then when you do that, you know, there will be a market for it. So it really, we have to to do this as a first step, but there's a lot more to do after that.
Yeah, agreed. I wrote 10 books on health before I got into banking, but I took a little training course in London on a little device called the Scanar, which was, it's like stimulates your electrical fields. And it was developed by Russians, and it was a Russian doctor who gave our course. And she said that in Russia, they didn't have any money. This was, well, I suppose it was, I can't remember when they developed it. But anyway, they didn't have any money, and it was their job to keep the people well. And so they didn't want the patients coming in. They want, you know, they wanted to keep them out of the office. And so they actively looked for things that were the most effective, least expensive remedies they could find, like things that cured everything or that worked on the system itself and kept you from getting these diseases. And it was very effective. And we have totally the wrong model. We have a model where they're looking for the things that will keep you ill so that they'll have a market.
Yeah. Right. I mean, France is the number one system, and you see it there in their policies. You know, their policies are really to prevent problems down the line. So, you know, for instance, when a woman delivers a child, they then have actual physical therapy for 6 weeks afterward to help them recover that muscle function so they don't have problems, you know, later on in life. And it's like, wow, what a common sense thing to do that makes, mm-hmm. you know, not only does it save healthcare dollars, but it improves the quality of life of
Well, also, you know, when healthcare becomes a public good, then you also have the situation where you look at not just things like healthcare, you look at things like food. And uh-huh. so the European approach to GMOs is very different from ours. You know, they don't want to put into their agricultural system and their food supply food that's going to make people less healthy. You know? And so, right. as Margaret, you often say that healthcare is a small percentage of health.
Right. I was talking to a man who said that the insurance statistics that they get, they know who's going to get a heart attack and who's going to get diabetes and so forth, but they don't share that information. But they could tell you ahead of time that your chart shows that you're in line for XYZ disease unless you change your habits. And his idea was you could give them some sort of like a trip to Hawaii or something. You give them some bonus for making some sort of goals like losing weight or whatever it would take to. But we don't do anything about prevention. It's all about treating symptoms after you're so far gone that all you can do is medicate or amputate or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was in Finland where they had a high rate of cardiovascular disease, and so the approach was a public health approach where they started building more walking trails and do public education about diet and exercise. But it wasn't just public education, it was also facilitating it, making it easier by putting services and resources into place for people so they could do that.
Yeah, and it worked, right? I take it.
And it worked, right? It did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I just have a few more minutes, but I was kind of just curious how you got, you're such avid activist, and how you got into all this and what motivated you from a young age.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, that's a good question. I guess that, you know, going into medicine was a field that I chose because I care about the well-being of people, and then practicing in this system and seeing that it wasn't about health and that it was actually driving my colleagues, who I thought were very good doctors, out of it through frustration with the system, and seeing that we, you know, have a country that could provide the best health system in the world, or, you know, a very good one, motivated me to, you know, to do that, to work for that. And then once you start taking a step towards activism, it's just you become more and more aware of, you know, what's the root cause of the problem. And, you know, it's kind of like once your eyes are open, you can't really turn back in good conscience. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot that we're going to have to do. I used to think it was really simple, that, oh, if we just worked really hard, we could make this change in a few years. But now I see that it's really a lifetime of work, and I may not see the results of that work, but hopefully I'll be part of the wave that creates the real change.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I feel that way too. And Kevin?
I got on this path in a very serious way in law school. I mean, I was active in smaller ways before that, but I got more serious about it in law school. I went to law school believing in life, living in pursuit of happiness. I saw people like Ramsey Clark and Ralph Nader and William Kunstler as kind of like the idols of, you know, lawyers using their education to advance a public good. And I got involved as an intern. I went to the professor in charge of internships, and I said I wanted to work as a criminal defense lawyer. And he suggested I work with NORML, the marijuana lobby, and I really didn't know much about it at the time, but I did, and I found some of the best lawyers in the country were organized in a legal committee in this kind of hippie group. And so I got a lot of lessons just by being part of NORML from some really great lawyers. And I guess just, you know, I saw injustice very clearly there. I mean, I started out responding to letters from people who were in prison or families of people who were in prison, and so I could see the very personal impact. I started to hear from people using marijuana medically, and their stories were amazing about how people with multiple sclerosis and glaucoma and suffering from the nausea of cancer therapy were amazingly helped. And so I got involved in that issue and litigating that issue. And then as I got into the marijuana issue, I really broadened out to deal with multiple aspects of it, impact on employment with drug testing, the drug war in Colombia and the use of the military, the attack on civil liberties. And so even there I saw multi-issue connections on many aspects of life. And in this century, I kind of broadened outside of the drug issue. I'm still working on trying to end the drug war. I work with a group called Common Sense for Drug Policy. We publish drugwarfacts.org, which is a great resource for people. Most of my work now is on many other issues that we've talked about in this interview. And I think working with Ralph Nader in 2004 was a big step of kind of like a graduate program in public policy, helping to write his policy statements and being his spokesperson. You know, working with him that closely was kind of a great education. And so then, you know, when we got involved in working on various issues together, Margaret and I and others that we work with kind of got frustrated by the lack of forward progress, and so we want to try new approaches, and we were inspired by the Egyptian revolt and the indignados in Spain and the Wisconsin revolt, and that's where Occupy came from in our minds, was those kinds of things. And so when we started to plan on that, we started really looking at what it takes to make change, and there really is a path, and I think we're on that path. As a great article by the late Bill Moyer called The 8 Stages of Social Movements, and we're right along the path of, we're probably in stage 6, and stage 7 is success. Now, stage 6 can last 10 or more years, so I'm not, you know, it's going to take work, but we are really following the path of successful social movements that have occurred throughout history, and so I'm pretty optimistic that we're going to see some positive change and solve some of these crises that we're facing.
Yeah, that's great. I actually when I went to law school, I did it because I wanted to work for Ralph Nader, but I applied and I didn't get the job. But anyway, but I'm still doing it.
I applied during law school too and didn't get the job. So, you know, life goes on.
Yeah. I saw that you ran for Congress, and you voted. What was your experience and why did you abandon politics?
Well, I ran for U.S. Senate in Maryland. It was during the Iraq War, and I ran mainly because the Democrat who was running, Ben Cardin, was saying he was anti-war when he was voting for all the war money, and I just didn't want him to get away with a free election where he could make that false claim, and so I wanted to make sure I was at forums that told people that what he really stood for, and I ran as a three-party candidate. It was nominated by the Greens, Libertarians, and Populists in Maryland. And got into debates. It was a great experience. But I really see our electoral system as so corrupt that it really can't be used for real change. It can be a tool for helping to build a mass movement. But I think the real task we have is building a mass movement. I think out of that kind of mass movement, everything comes. And there's research that shows that resistance movements over the last 100 years, if you can get 3.5% of the people active, you will not lose. If you're standing for something that the majority supports, and I think everything we stand for, polls show majority support. if we get 3.5% of people taking action, we will win. And I think we are approaching 1%, so we've got a ways to go. That's my guess. No one does a real census of that, but looking at the various movements that are involved in the current struggles, I think we're approaching 1%. And so I think Occupy is about, 0.1%, so we're making progress. Occupy is about 350,000 people, so it was a tiny step. But now we're, I think, expanding, and people are getting more involved. So, again, I see a mass movement is the key. The electoral arena is a tool, but we really live in a mirage democracy with managed elections, so I don't think that's where the change is going to come from initially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree. Now that I've gotten involved, I see how difficult it is. It's, first of all, there's so many hoops to jump through just to stay in the race. And if you don't have a staff, it's kind of overwhelming. And I can also see why politicians they seem to not know very much. It seems like they must be taking their information from advisors, but I can see why they don't have time to read the whole field and get a real feeling for what's going on in the world.
Well, it's not about what you know. It's not about the position you take. It's really about raising money and getting media attention and working with the political machine. That's what gets people elected. And, the positions they don't, and that's why a movement makes so much difference, because a movement will shift positions. Now, Richard Nixon ended the Vietnam War, and Nixon started OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the EPA. He updated the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, opened the doors to China. I mean, this is an anti-communist right-winger. He did that because there was a social movement that demanded it. And so I think that it's not who's in office, that counts. It's really what we're doing and how organized and mobilized we are. And the better mobilized we are, the more impact we'll have on very malleable politicians who really don't stand for much.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all very inspiring. I guess I've come to the end of my time. Do you want to say what your websites are and any upcoming?
Well, the most important website is Popular Resistance. That's popularresistance.org. And you can see all the other work we do from that site. On the right-hand side, we link to the other projects that we'd work on. But Popular Resistance really tries to bring the various movements, the various sub-movements together, give people tools, information, so they can, help to build the movement. And I think that's really where it all flows from. So if you go to popularresistance.org, you can find our radio show, our economic project, and other projects we're working on. So that's where I'd start.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
Thanks for having us on.
Alan.
We appreciate it.
Bye.
It's time now for the Public Banking Report, a quick look at what's going on in the world of the public banking movement. And today we have a special guest, Mark Armstrong, the former executive director of the Public Banking Institute, who started a new initiative called BankAct.org, focusing on creating postal banks.
So, Mark, tell us how BankAct came about and what role you see that organization playing.
Sure. BankAct, which is a 501c4, means that BankAct is much more of a lobbying organization. So we're a member organization. BankAct is an organization which is basically building the people's lobby to establish a U.S. postal bank. And so the focus initially is on postal banking. And what we want to do is enable people to start lobbying at the local level for postal banks. There are well over 30,000 post offices in the U.S., and many of them are being closed. And in addition to that being a problem, there's a huge problem with regards to the unbanked or the underserved. A report just came out from the Office of the Inspector General within the Postal Service identifying 1 in 4 U.S. households living at least partially outside the financial mainstream. And so a U.S. Post Office network in those 30-plus thousand post offices can provide a core set of payment and banking services to that demographic and really help them, because it's costing them about $2,400, which is basically a month's income over the course of a year in interest and fees. So that's what we're working on right now.
So the postal bank is the lever into the financial system that a public banking model can realistically take in the near term.
Yeah, as you know, there are lots of different public banking models. The one we're focused on, which is a postal bank, which is also a public bank, but it's at the national level, not at the state or local level, and it's also focused more on providing retail services. And so that makes it distinctly different. It does make it sort of unique because it would be part of the Postal Service, and that's a different spin on things, but as a public entity, that would qualify it as a public bank.
And it's got historic precedent, doesn't it?
Right. You know, in my research, there have been a number of different groups in the beginning of the early 1890s that began lobbying for a postal bank. Finally, one was established in 1911, and that was in existence through both world wars as well as into the 1960s. And then because it was limited in terms of savings interest rate it could provide, a lot of people started putting their money in other retail banks. And the post office saw a lot of business go away, and they finally closed it down, I think, in 1966, 1967. So what happened is then is, you know, people recognized that there was a well-established middle class in the United States, and the private banking system was meeting the needs of those people. But things have changed dramatically in the last 40, 50 years. The middle class, you know, the safety net's been kicked out from underneath it, and a lot of people are ending up as one of those 1 in 4 U.S. households that the Inspector General report identified as basically living outside the financial mainstream without bank accounts, or they're having to pay for payday loans.
And it's a bit of a rescue mechanism also for the post office.
Yeah, the Postal Service has had operating profits in the past, and it changed the nature of the service it's providing is more trending more towards packages and less first-class mail, and so that affects its revenue. But the biggest hit on the Postal Service is that the U.S. Congress mandated that it set aside revenues to fund health care pensions for employees who haven't even been born yet, 70 years into the future. So you end up with this red ink on paper. But the reality is that the Postal Service is fairly healthy, and it's running a loss, though, because of the congressional mandated set-asides for the pension fund. So what will happen is if the Postal Service offers postal banking services, and there's lots of different types of postal banking services, people can find out more by just going to our website at bankact.org. But if you take a look at the revenue stream associated with that, roughly it's about $86 billion a year in fees and services that payday lenders and cash checkers are enjoying right now. So if the Postal Service got just 10%, that's $8.6 billion a year. So that would be a big help.
So Bank Act is going to help provide organizational support for local people to get to their representatives and media. Is that your strategy, essentially, to create the political moves toward postal banking?
Yes, and it takes shape in two forms. One is at the national level. We're forming the Postal Banking Council, comprised of labor groups as well as other stakeholder-type organizations, whether it's immigrants or women. You know, the largest demographic for payday lenders is working women between the age of 25 and 34. So it's these stakeholder-type organizations which will be part of the Postal Banking Council. And the second piece to this, which, as you mentioned, is really important, is grassroots effort. Phones need to be ringing in congressional offices in order to demonstrate support for this idea. And so we'll be publishing the papers, sound bites, things like that, which people will need to use in order to help them make the case for a postal bank. You know, we expect to launch our campaign late this year, and I'm sure there will be some Congress people as well as senators who will be involved in crafting some legislation at that point. I expect it less than a year from now that there'll be something in play.
So any current legislators that would be champions of this, do you think?
Well, Senator Elizabeth Warren came out strongly in support of the Inspector General's report, which was issued in late January. Within a week, she had an op-ed published in support of this. And so that was kind of the genesis of our putting this organization together, Bank Act. The reason why is because I had not expected this development to occur for a while. And I was somewhat surprised by the vocal support as well as the major endorsements across the web, whether it's in the Harvard Business Review or any one of a number of different publications coming out in support of postal banking. So we thought it was a good time to organize that support. Bank Act is the only organization that is lobbying for a postal bank, and because of that, we think we'll be able to further this over the course of the next couple of years. It'll be more like 2 years out, I suspect.
Well, this is a very exciting development, and we're going to spend more time talking with you about this at more length, but I want to let people know that to connect with this initiative, they should go to BankAct, that's ACT.org, and you get a good background on what the organization is up to and how it's developing and how you can participate, and also a lot of resources there as well. Mark, thanks so much for taking the time this morning, and we look forward to talking to you more extensively in the near future.
Great. Thanks so much, Walt.
That's Mark Armstrong from BankAct.org. Well, that will do it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. You can listen to any of our previous shows by going to our show links on PRN.FM. And for more information about public banking and what's going on in that movement, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Our thanks to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia and to you for listening. I'm Walt McCree. Join us next time as we explore behind the curtain of monetary control on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money.